as a protagonist of this moment and of this process. And for us, that is a major concern, because we're our major concern now is knowing that it's not the 50% of women in this process doesn't guarantee that feminism will be a protagonist. For us, it's a necessity that feminism is all around, it's in the institutional process, but also outside in the streets, mobilizing this desire and this need for a social transformation. And for us, it's important to protagonize this process with our demands, with our program, with what we've held during the feminist strikes. For the Mapuche movements today, precisely during these hours, there's a very important vote that's been in the Congress being discussed.
We just have 10 seconds, Javiera.
Yes, revolt in Chile is a plurinational revolt. And now there's they're discussing the possibility of Mapuche people and indigenous people to have to participate in this convention.
Javiera Manzi, I want to thank you so much for being with us, with the Coordinadora Feminista 8M, and also Pablo Vivanco speaking to us from Canada. This is Democracy Now! I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Guess what? It's fall, so that means it's time for KBOO's annual membership meeting. Join us Saturday, November 7th from 2 to 4 p.m. via Zoom to hear updates about the station, meet candidates running for 4 open board seats, and participate in a lively discussion about KBOO in the year 2020 and beyond. Featuring performing artists Scooter Rogers, Rain Ezra, and host Trista Tyree. To get the link for the meeting, register online by visiting our website kboo.fm/meeting2020. That's kboo.fm/meeting2020.
KBOO Community Radio encourages all our listeners, whatever your political affiliation, to vote. October 27th is the last day to safely mail in your ballot. The last day to drop off your ballot at a Dropbox site is November 3rd by 8 p.m. If you have any difficulties getting to a ballot Dropbox, poll workers are providing ballot pickups. These resources and more information on voting can be found at kboo.fm/election resources.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, a cash assistance program meant to help Portlanders in need maxed out after just 5 minutes on Tuesday. Oregonians are encouraged to drop off their ballots instead of mailing them in to ensure they're counted, and a group of protesters spoke with Commissioner Dan Ryan outside his home yesterday. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 28th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. On Wednesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 424 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of confirmed and presumptive cases up to 43,228. Oregon health officials also reported 7 new deaths, bringing the state's death toll up to 671 people. Multnomah County had the highest number, with 110 new COVID-19 cases. Oregon Governor Kate Brown extended the state of emergency on Tuesday for another 60 days. It will now continue until January 2, 2021. Governor Brown said yesterday, quote, "The second wave of COVID-19 has arrived in the United States. We must continue to work together and follow the simple steps that have kept us safe throughout the pandemic: washing our hands, wearing face coverings, watching our physical distance, staying home when sick, and avoiding social get-togethers, especially indoors. The states of Oregon, Washington, California, and Nevada are planning to team up to vet any potential COVID-19 vaccines before distributing them to the public. In a press release, Governor Brown said, quote, "The independent review conducted by this panel of doctors, scientists, and health experts will ensure that a safe and effective COVID-19 vaccine is available to everyone, especially communities that have been disproportionately impacted by this disease." California Governor Gavin Newsom first created the COVID-19 Scientific Safety Review Workgroup in late September with the purpose of independently reviewing the safety and efficacy of possible vaccines. Health experts worry about the public perception of the Trump administration's vaccine project. There are concerns that even if the vaccine is safe and effective, the public won't get vaccinated due to the lack of trust in the administration. The hope of this independent review is that the extra vetting will help restore some of that trust and encourage people to vaccinate. Nationally, more than 8.8 million people in the United States have been infected with COVID-19. At least 227,000 people with the virus have died across the country. Over the past week, there have been an average of about 71,000 cases per day, an increase of 40% from the average we saw 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 44 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.1 million people have died across the world. On Tuesday, the city of Portland began accepting applications for its latest round of financial assistance in the form of 1,400 debit cards loaded with $500 each. The assistance is meant to help low-income Portlanders who have been financially impacted by COVID-19. The application was open for a total of 5 minutes, by which time the city had already collected more than the allotted amount of applications and were forced to close submissions. Eligibility requirements for applicants included being over the age of 18, being a resident of Portland, and having experienced a loss of income or increased health risk due to COVID-19. Applicants were also required to have a household income at or below 80% of the area median income, meaning less than approximately $50,000. Though the financial assistance will help some, there's an obvious need for more help from the government. A study done by Portland State University in September found that 53% of Portland renters have cut back on food and medications just to be able to pay rent during the pandemic. Tuesday's application submission window was the first of two opportunities to apply for the $500 card this week. Portlanders will have another chance to apply on Friday at 1 p.m. With the election just 6 days away, Oregonians are strongly encouraged to drop their ballots off rather than mailing them. Actions taken by Postmaster General Louis DeJoy have significantly slowed mail delivery in many parts of the country. Oregon ballots must be received by Tuesday, November 3rd, and in this case, postmark dates don't count. Voters can find their nearest drop box location at the Secretary of State's website, sos.oregon.gov/voting. Ballot boxes will be open until 8 p.m. on November 3rd. Multnomah County voters who may have been expecting a ballot but had not received one yet are encouraged to reach out to the Multnomah County Elections Office at 503-988-8683. And for questions about voting with disabilities, voters are encouraged to call 503-988-3720. Oregonians are casting early ballots at higher rates than they did in 2016. In Multnomah County, over half of all registered voters have already dropped off their ballots. Nationally, more people have already cast ballots in this year's presidential election than the number of people who voted early or absentee in 2016. A group of around 100 protesters gathered in front of the Justice Center yesterday to hold a vigil for Walter Wallace Jr., a black man killed by Philadelphia police on Monday. Wallace was in a state of mental distress, and after refusing to drop the knife he was holding, was shot more than a dozen times by law enforcement officers. The group observed a moment of silence around 7:30 p.m. and sang "Lift Every Voice and Sing" as candles lined the steps up to the building. Later in the evening, some protesters marched along Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, while others met at Arbor Lodge Park. At around 11 p.m., the two groups converged at Portland City Commissioner Dan Ryan's house. Ryan holds a pivotal role in the decision of whether or not to further defund the Portland Police Bureau. After several chants from the crowd, Ryan told demonstrators he would come out to have a, quote, honest discussion with them if they agreed. A semicircle of around 75 protesters sat around Ryan, who stood in front of his house. They spoke for about an hour. At Ryan's request, the group agreed to limit documentation of the discussion so that he could adequately express his position. At the end of the conversation, however, Ryan declined to say how he plans to vote. So far, only Commissioners Joanne Hardesty and Chloe U. Daly have pledged to vote to further defund Portland Police Bureau by $18 million, a drop in the bucket of PPB's over $200 million per year budget. A vote on whether or not to defund the Portland Police Bureau by $18 million will take place on Wednesday afternoon, with the possible postponement until next week's City Council meeting. Conservation groups are calling on Oregon officials to protect our emblematic Oregon species, the beaver. Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service has more on the story.
Conservation groups are urging Oregon officials to protect an iconic state animal, the beaver. Organizations have submitted a petition to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission calling on the state to prohibit commercial and recreational beaver hunting and trapping on federally managed public lands. Sristi Kamel, senior Northwest representative for Defenders of Wildlife, says added together, these lands make up about half of the state's acreage. She says Oregon ecosystems depend on beavers.
Beavers improve water quality, maintain or increase stream flows, create and increase the amount of distribution of wetlands, wet meadows, ponds, create refuge and fire breaks during wildfires like the one we saw recently, and store carbon and increase and diversify habitats.
Defenders of Wildlife and nine other groups and individuals are part of the petition. The commission will consider the petition at its November 13th meeting. Kamel says hunting and trapping season lasts from November to March, overlapping with the beaver's breeding season, which is January to March. She believes the benefits from beavers outweigh the benefits for hunters and trappers, of which there are fewer than 170 registered in the state. Kamel adds that Oregon doesn't offer protections for this species.
It would be the first measure we are taking in the state to do something about the one animal that's actually on our state flag. I mean, we are the beaver state, you know, so we should do more than just have the animal on our state flag.
If the commission accepts the petition, it would begin a round of rulemaking on regulations. Kamel says the public can participate in the hearing by registering on the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife website or submitting comments to the commission. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Over 4,000 medical professionals around the country agree that climate change takes a significant toll on patient health, and they're demanding policy change. Mike Mullen with the Public News Service has more on the story.
More than 4,000 medical professionals from across the country are demanding policy action on climate change. The coalition includes more than a dozen doctors and nurses from Iowa who say the effects are visible in the patients they serve. These healthcare professionals have signed a letter asking their patients to get behind political candidates willing to consider the issue. John McAtee is a retired doctor from Iowa City who practiced family medicine. He says there are concerns within the medical community about climate change resulting in poor health outcomes. For example, in Iowa, he says there's a ripple effect within agriculture.
There's ever-increasing severity of weather changes causing flooding, which is decreasing crop yields and depression and suicide.
In a 2019 report from the Iowa Policy Project, the authors predict the Midwest will see the biggest spike in premature deaths related to rising temperatures linked to climate change. And while polls show more people, including younger conservatives, acknowledging the impact of a warming climate, many candidates still express support for the oil industry. In asking patients to seek out politicians who support action on climate change, McAtee says it isn't about partisanship. He calls this a human issue.
Just like COVID, it's affecting us all, whether we're Republicans or Democrats or independents.
One of the groups in the coalition is the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health. Some of the key demands include leaders who prioritize renewable energy over fossil fuels and those who pay close attention to the science and medical communities. Mike Mullen, Public News Service.
A recent poll found that in many states, Latinx voters say they were personally affected by climate change last year. Here's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Nevada, about 20% of voters are Latino, and a growing number are deeply concerned about climate change. A recent poll found that almost half the state's Latino voters say they were personally affected by climate change in the last year.
We look at it as not only climate change or the environment, but we're also looking at it as the health aspect.
Rudy Zamora is with Chispa Nevada, a program of the League of Conservation Voters. He says many Latinos know firsthand how rising temperatures can worsen other problems. For example, air pollution.
How does the climate change impact our community's health? How does that impact the way that our children are breathing?
For Zamora, the concern about air quality is personal. About 2 years ago, his young son suffered a frightening asthma attack. It was so bad that his son went into respiratory failure and cardiac arrest. And he says his son is not the only one to have such severe problems. Many people in the community struggle with asthma. So with the November elections approaching, Chispa Nevada encourages Latinos to compare candidates' positions on the environment and then vote.
Climate is going to be one of the top priorities on why we go out and vote.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned for The Underground at 6, then at 7 it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 43 degrees, and tomorrow expect partly cloudy skies with a high of 63. Today in history, in 1950, Tunisian journalist and human rights activist Sihem Ben Sedrin was born. In 2015, she became the head of the country's Truth and Dignity Commission, where she investigates crimes of the pre-revolutionary regime in Tunisia. The quote of the day is from audio artist Frank Ocean, who was also born today in 1987. Quote, "Don't confuse my personality with my attitude. My personality is who I am. My attitude depends on who you are." A federal court has declined to stop the Keystone XL pipeline construction. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A federal judge has declined to issue an order to stop construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. That does not mean the pipeline is free of legal obstacles. The order is part of a lawsuit against President Trump by the Rosebud Sioux Tribe and the Fort Belknap Indian community. Victoria Wicks reports.
Judge Brian Morris has ruled that the 2019 presidential permit allows construction of only the 1.2 miles of pipeline that crossed the international border. That segment was completed earlier this year. Tribes and environmentalists have held that the permit authorizes the entire 875 miles of pipe. In their lawsuit, the tribes claim violation of treaty rights, sovereignty, and mineral and water rights. Judge Morris finds that within the short border crossing, those rights aren't violated. The judge notes in his order that the 2019 presidential permit does not exempt the pipeline from laws governing public land use or requiring environmental analysis. He notes that those federal laws apply to the entire pipeline, including the segment at the border. Morris notes that TC Energy successfully applied to the Bureau of Land Management for a right-of-way to cross the border, and the tribes challenged that decision. He says the BLM right-of-way is tied up in other litigation that is just now getting started, and the tribes could intervene in one of those suits or file a separate action to be heard simultaneously. The question still remains whether the president had the authority to issue a permit for the pipeline or if he encroached on the power of Congress to regulate foreign commerce. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Federal Communications Commission says it's taken unprecedented steps towards closing the digital divide on tribal lands. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr has more.
The FCC estimates that nearly half of households on rural tribal lands don't have access to broadband service, compared to just 8% nationally. That's why the agency has granted exclusive licenses to a frequency band to more than 150 tribes and tribal entities. Tribes had a 7-month window to take advantage of the offer, which closed last month. The FCC just announced that they're now reviewing 400 applications, with 154 approved so far. Danae Wilson heads up Nez Perce Systems, which received a license. It's one of only a handful of tribally owned internet providers in the country. But Wilson says these licenses could lead to the creation of dozens more like it.
I anticipate by the end of next year, the end of the next 2 years, that there will be hundreds of wireless internet service providers on reservation. And it's really an exciting day for Indian country.
Tribes who choose not to create their own internet providers will be able to lease their frequency bands to telecom companies and receive both broadband service and revenue in return. I'm Savannah Marr.
The Navajo Nation Council hosted White House policy advisors and federal officials Tuesday in Window Rock, Arizona. They addressed a number of priorities touching on how COVID-19 has presented challenges, but say work has not stopped on the federal level. Catherine Sullivan is with the Department of Justice Office of Intergovernmental Affairs.
You can see it on a map and you can read about it, but there is nothing like visiting Indian country and then bringing that passion and back with you to Washington, D.C. as you work on issues. I think it's so important, this government-to-government relationship that we have and the trust responsibility that we have to you.
Navajo Nation Council members and the Washington delegation discussed public safety, health care, broadband infrastructure, missing and murdered Indigenous people, and other needs during the day-long event. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
After a Trump rally outside Omaha last night, multiple Trump supporters were taken to area hospitals for hypothermia. 25,000 people had been driven to the rally site by 40 buses running from 10 a.m. until the rally began at 8 p.m. Because of poor planning, many waited for hours after the rally had ended in 30-degree temperatures, with the last buses leaving around midnight. Tired of waiting, some people chose to walk the couple miles back to the parking areas, creating more traffic difficulties. Some left the site in ambulances instead of buses. After waiting in the cold, at least 30 people required medical attention. An investigative reporter says that more than 16 million voters, mostly Democrats and people of color, have been purged from the voting rolls in the United States. With more on that story and others, we turn to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
You may rely on the post office, but we're getting close to their window in some states where they won't guarantee delivery by election day. And so there are other ways to get that ballot cast.
Trevor Potter with the Campaign Legal Center and other good government groups are urging voters to cast their ballots ASAP. League of Women Voters President Virginia Case recommends bringing your ballot to a secure drop box, or if you must mail, do it now.
There are regional postmasters and there are regions where mail may move quicker or slower. We have seen a lot of improvement, but we are still concerned about the holdup of mail.
It's already iffy in states with strict ballot receipt deadlines like Georgia, Michigan, and now Wisconsin. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled their ballots must arrive before polls close on November 3rd. The court has similar cases for fiercely contested North Carolina and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania election officials have asked newly sworn-in Justice Amy Coney Barrett to recuse herself from that case. Given Republicans' consistent efforts to halt vote by mail and their rush to appoint her specifically to rule on election cases, many Democrats fear the worst if the presidency comes down to the Supreme Court, like the 2000 election of Republican George Bush. His 2004 opponent, John Kerry, says he didn't challenge Bush's Ohio victory then because he knew he would lose in the Supreme Court. Journalist Norman Solomon says former Vice President Joe Biden needs to win an electoral landslide.
I think Biden needs a big victory margin in electoral votes, getting way over 300 of them, to really undercut the chances Republicans can steal it. I worry about any margin smaller than that.
Investigative reporter Greg Pallast says that Democratic voters, especially voters of color, have been purged from the rolls in battleground states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Georgia.
In the last 2 years, 16.7 million voters have been purged, that is, removed from the voter rolls. 16 1.7 million voters. Millions are going to show up at the polls and find they can't vote.
Demanding identification at the polls, such as driver's licenses, passports, and birth certificates, is another barrier for folks who don't drive, travel internationally, or carry around birth certificates. In Lansing, Michigan, yesterday, President Trump again expressed his support for voter ID laws.
There's no cheating with that. You go to a place, they want identification, they want this, you fill out your form, they walk you over to a machine, you put it in.
Yesterday, Biden campaigned in Georgia, where polls show a tight race despite Republican victories since 1992. Meanwhile, 20 Republican former federal prosecutors across the country endorsed Biden, calling Trump, quote, a threat to the rule of law. Former NYC Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced a $15 million contribution to candidates in Texas and Ohio, as polls show both states may be in play this year. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Voting machines once had levers, and this year, in Michigan at least, there may be triggers at polling locations. In a tight legal battle, a Michigan judge struck down a recent ruling by the Secretary of State which banned guns within 100 feet of polling places. The state attorney general's office plans to appeal the court ruling. The Trump campaign has encouraged its supporters to show up at polling places as, quote, monitors. Conservative groups in several states have announced they'll be at the polls, armed. Earlier this month, a group of militia members in Michigan were arrested for plotting to kidnap the governor. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is nearly overwhelmed by death news.
Walter Williams Jr. isn't on any ballot, but millions are saying his name, murdered Monday by Philadelphia police. The night before, Matthew Choi, known for his kimchi, was murdered in his southeast Portland apartment. No one has been arrested for either slaying. Trump complained yesterday about COVID getting more attention than him, bragged about America's incredible progress, and yes, 500,000 new cases in 1 week is incredible, but the opposite of progress, of leadership, of caring. But even in places with strong leaders in national health care, COVID continues to surge. Hospital beds reaching capacity in Belgium, the Netherlands airlifting patients to Germany, France is imposing a 4-week national lockdown. Pick a country, any country, too many deaths worldwide to count. Yes, this is the most important election in our lives, but it's just a big pothole in the road, and there's a long, bleak trip ahead. Don't mail your ballot. Drop it off. Wearing a mask. Wash your hands when you get home. Call a friend to see how they're doing. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Will the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic prompt more food stockpiling? Experts say we shouldn't worry. Roz Brown with the Public News Service has more.
America has never seen the type of disruption to its food supply chain experienced by grocery stores until the onslaught of COVID-19. But experts don't expect it to happen again, even if folks stock up for winter. Anne Marie Roerink, who tracks grocery sales for the firm 2010 Analytics, says the second week of March saw a spike in sales of bleach, Lysol, thermometers, and toilet paper. But the last 2 weeks of March saw people buying food staples, some of which might surprise you.
We see the same exact thing during hurricanes, blizzards, for whatever reason. I think it goes back to one of those base needs, right? You want milk, you want Pop-Tarts is another one, for whatever reason.
Roerink says meat sales nearly doubled in the spring, and people also bought canned fruit and vegetables, although sales of fresh produce are now back to normal. She adds that there continues to be a big run on cleaning materials and disinfectant products. The supply chain hasn't broken down since early in the pandemic, but Roerink notes that people have continued to spend more money at the grocery store since mid-March.
Those were the biggest weeks that grocery has ever seen. And so this was the entire country, and it didn't matter what region, if it was cities or rural, everybody was in the store, and virtually every shelf in the store was empty.
Roerink adds oranges continue to be some of the most popular items as people attempt to build up their immune systems to ward off COVID-19. Because many can't or won't go to restaurants, she says they're cooking more at home than pre-pandemic.
We continue to see that people are not in stores as often as they used to be, but when they are in store, they buy a whole lot more.
According to CoreSite Research, online grocery sales also could surge 40% by year's end due to nationwide concerns about COVID-19. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Hannah Merzbach, Nat Moon, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Ross Brown, Antonio Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, Mike Moen, and Eric Tegeda. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, bringing you the latest news happening in African American and Black society. At 9, we'll hear a radio zine, bringing us intriguing public affairs programming. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's Between the Covers, which features interviews with locally and nationally known authors. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are in the final week of our fall membership drive. In this final week, we have a match from a generous donor of $5,000, which can double the impact of your donation. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A measure to bring tuition-free preschool to all 3 and 4-year-olds in Multnomah County is on the November ballot as Measure 26-214. This measure would prioritize kids from marginalized communities and give preschool teachers a living wage. The program would be funded by a tiered tax on high-income earners that is estimated to create 7,000 new preschool slots by 2026. If the measure is passed, individuals making over $125,000 and households making over $200,000 will be taxed between 1.5% and 3%. This tax will increase slightly in 2026 to expand the program's capacity. The measure is the result of a merger of two parallel campaigns: the Preschool for All campaign, led by Commissioner Jessica Vada Peterson, and the Universal Preschool Now campaign, a citizen-led initiative that had over 30,000 petition signatures. The two coalitions merged to give voters one all-encompassing measure on the ballot. There is no organized opposition to the measure. Evan Birchfield is the co-chair of the Portland chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, one of the key organizations working on the campaign. He boils down the measure to a few key points.
One of the things that we say about universal preschool is that it's good for kids, it's good for parents, and it's good for workers. This is something that for kids growing up, this is going to greatly improve their ability to participate in the world and to be healthy and to be to not be segregated. This is actually a way to combat segregation. And then it's good for parents because of the economic issues, and it's good for workers because of workplace justice and minimum wage.
Oregon currently has the 4th most expensive preschools in the country. Preschools often cost as much as rent in Multnomah County, and there are only enough slots for about 15% of 3 and 4-year-olds. This renders preschool inaccessible for middle to low-income Portlanders, many of whom belong to a marginalized group. These children miss out on the lifelong benefits of preschool. Studies like the Perry Preschool Project have found that kids who went to preschool performed better in later grades, were more likely to graduate high school, and were more likely to hold a job and have higher earnings in later life. Tina LaManna, who teaches second grade at Markham Elementary, acts as the Portland Association of Teachers' liaison to the Preschool for All measure. She attests the differences in the classroom between the kids who attended and did not attend preschool.
You know, when you see kids starting in public schools, you can generally tell who's been to preschool and who hasn't. For one thing, it's just the skills to be in a classroom and just the idea that when we all come to the carpet and have a lesson on the carpet, we expect you to come too. And that can be a really hard thing for some kids to quite wrap their heads around at the beginning of kindergarten. And then also sort of the, again, not the academic skills per se, but the foundation to build academic skills on. If we could close the gap between where kids are coming into public schools, I think that would make a huge difference for educators and also especially for the kids and their families.
Attending preschools can especially help narrow the gap for children who immigrate to the United States. Ricardo Lujan Valero, the director of advocacy at the Latino Network and a member of the Preschool for All campaign, said that attending preschool helped him adjust to life in the United States and shape his identity.
I'm an immigrant myself. I grew up in Mexico, and I was very fortunate to grow up in a household where my mom was a teacher, and she had her own preschool in Mexico. And so, you know, me being a product of a preschool system actually allowed me to get that experience early on. You know, the biggest shift for me was really, you know, the shift of environments and dynamics from like a Mexican educational system to a U.S. educational system when I moved to the U.S. about, you know, in the fourth grade. But the fact that I had already had extensive classroom exposure, you know, a teacher exposure, actually prepared me for that transition a lot better than what I've seen with other of my colleagues and other of my community members that are also undocumented, you know, or DACA recipient or immigrants in general that didn't have that preschool experience like I did in Mexico. So, you know, the need for early learning education in that level of a preschool level is really not just a universal need here in Multnomah County and in the state. It's nationwide, right? It's global. And it has a lot of implications to the development of that identity of an individual.
There are similar preschool programs in other cities like Seattle and New York, but Lujan Valero said that these models focus more on building up existing systems rather than building new ones that are culturally appropriate for their communities. Portland's Preschool for All program will start by offering slots to children in priority populations, including children of color, children with developmental delays or disabilities, and children living in foster care.
The larger implications is, and this is really where the rubber meets the road for Preschool for All, is the centering of the community, the centering of the kiddos that are part of, you know, historically and currently underserved communities to be centered in that work. So in other words, not only providing them a slot for preschool, but making sure that it's free, making sure that it's culturally appropriate, and that the providers themselves actually have that cultural experience and exposure that you want to see, right? So we're addressing some of the things that we see right now in K-12 and higher ed when, you know, you ask students what they want, they say, I want a teacher that actually looks like me. We want to make sure that we actually build a preschool system that does that.
The Preschool for All coalitions are ensuring that programs will be culturally appropriate by putting parents and representatives from marginalized communities front and center. Lydia Gray Holifield, a parent leader at the Early Learning Multnomah Parent Accountability Council, is making sure that the voices of Black and Brown families are brought to the table.
We've been able to sit in places as parents that we were never invited to before. Parents' voices don't really matter to a lot of people. Generally, what happens is there's a bunch of white people get together and they make all these beautiful decisions that they think that are going to be just perfect for everybody. And then when it comes down to it, it's not perfect for everybody. Everybody doesn't get a voice, because guess who didn't get that voice? That parent, or that child, or the grandma, or the community. Being at the table and being able to say, we want classrooms that have brown and Black people on the wall. We want classrooms that have teachers that look like me when I walk in the door. Teachers' assistants. We as a community got together and decided we wanted to make sure that not only did the teachers look like them, they have a livable wage. Like, that's important. I can't ask you to take care of my child, and you can't take care of your home. How is that fair?
Currently, the median salary for preschool teachers is just over $30,000. This measure would ensure that preschool teachers are earning a similar salary to the average kindergarten teacher, which is about $74,000. Assistant preschool teachers would be guaranteed an hourly wage of at least $18 an hour, 35% higher than the minimum wage in the Portland metro area. In addition to ensuring living wages for workers, primarily women and women of color, the measure ensures that existing and new preschools in Multnomah County remain neutral if employees decide to form a union. Will Lang, the executive director of Portland Jobs with Justice and a member of the Preschool for All campaign, tells us how this will address economic injustices in the county.
The measure will help improve economic situation for everyone in our community. We see in Multnomah County a really dramatic and concerning growth of income inequality, where we have a high number of wealthy people. Our county continues to become wealthier and wealthier, but leaving behind more and more folks in our community, where we see poverty increasing dramatically at the same time as wealth is increasing for a few. And so this measure, with what it does to both improve outcomes, offer more opportunities for everyone to have good quality preschool, and what it does around improving wages for workers is dramatically better and will lift a low wage, primarily female workers of color out of or into a better economic position than they have been, with significantly improved wages. My daughter's in second grade and went through a really good preschool program that really benefited and set her up well for elementary school. Even just in her wonderful preschool that she was part of, we saw high turnover among teachers and staff, and I would attribute that to low wages that it pays, even though the cost of tuition can be very, very high.
Currently, many early childhood educators find themselves teaching at K-12 schools in order to earn a living wage. Tina Lamana, the second grade teacher, has a master's in early childhood education, but turned to K-12 early on in order to pay back her loans.
When people become highly qualified, they often get pushed out, and that's, it's not fair, it's not right, you know? There's a lot of people who have a lot of skills that aren't currently doing this job because they're not being compensated fairly, or they wouldn't be compensated fairly. A lot of these people are making minimum wage and really treated as disposable. And it's causing huge problems, first of all, for early childhood teachers who are trying to support their families. But I think it's also really affecting the kids in the programs, because you're seeing things like revolving doors on staff in a lot of these centers. And that makes it impossible for children to build relationships. And of course, young children really need those relationships, and they need stability and routines. And you can't have any of those things if your teacher is quitting every 6 months because she realized that she can make more money bagging groceries at New Seasons.
The measure supporters hope to professionalize the early childhood workforce with living wages and additional trainings. They hope to improve the quality of life for these workers and families through income redistribution, as Evan Birchfield from the Democratic Socialists of America said.
I think for us as socialists, we are always looking out for, we're working class people, and we're trying to fight as the working class, and this is a working class demand. It is a working class demand to say that in order to be a parent and also receive enough funds to be a human being, that in order to actually go out and live in the world, that we absolutely have to have income redistribution. And so inequality is something that this measure attacks. Inequality is one of the things that prevents people from being able to live healthy, robust lives while they have kids and are trying to work. Yes, this is absolutely about the working class, and this is about addressing inequality, and it's about taxing the rich.
This measure comes in a time where income redistribution policies are making their way into mainstream politics. It also comes during a global health crisis and social upheaval. COVID-19 has exposed the lack of accessible childcare and education options for working families. Yet Lujan Valero from the Latino Network said Preschool for All was necessary far before the pandemic.
The fact that COVID-19 happened actually doesn't necessarily doesn't provide the argument about why are we doing this right now, but rather saying, why haven't we done this already? So make sure that we actually step up to the demand. What we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic is both the inequities that the Latinx specifically and disproportionately faced, but the lack of accessibility to these kinds of services for essential workers, right? So you have folks that are working in the field that now have to figure out how to take care of their children because they are not being taken care of for whatever reason. And so, if anything, right now is a time to be able to build up, as we're building and reconstructing our infrastructures and our economic systems, to really prioritize early learning and really prioritize the future of our county. And then ultimately, you know, once this becomes successful, use it as a blueprint and the basis for a catalyst of a conversation that can happen in other counties statewide, and really make this beyond just Multnomah County. My usual experience with initiatives is that it takes a while for them to really boil up, right? It takes a while for them to really have conversations on implementation. And oftentimes the implementation conversations happen at the end of a campaign rather than in the beginning. What's been fantastic is that under the, you know, the leadership of Commissioner Peterson in Multnomah County, and the leadership of so many community-based organizations, practitioners, and parents, we've been able to build that pretty well already. And so we already have a roadmap with so many implementing aspects that can be done literally on day one when we start having these conversations of implementation. That's something that you don't really see happen often in many campaigns. And so this has been really well cooked out. Again, the fact that it's been going on for over 2 years now just tells you the commitment, the passion, and the need that the community truly thinks there is in Multnomah County.
The Preschool for All measure is an investment in the future of the families in Multnomah County and beyond, parent leader Gray Hollifield said.
This measure is something that will continue to keep giving. It won't stop giving. You know, some things you invest in it, and then in a year, 2 years, 3 years down the line, it fades out. This won't fade out. This will be a priceless investment that will continue to give from years to come. When my great-great-grandkids are going to high school or going to preschool or whatever, this is something that will continue to give over and over again.
The Preschool for All measure 26214 will be on the November ballot in Multnomah County. If passed, the income tax will be in effect on January 1st, 2021, and the first Preschool for All programs will open in fall 2022. For KBOO News in Depth, this is Hannah Merzbach.